I'm told that yesterday somebody came up here and said, "Can anybody here actually explain Obamacare?" And it kills me that I wasn't here. I've been waiting. That's like my bat signal. I've been waiting for that to happen my entire life. Like, like doctors will tell the story of the time they were in the grocery store and somebody collapsed. Being in a room where just somebody shouts out, "Can anybody explain Obamacare?" It's the one thing where I could be a hero.
Welcome to It's All Journalism. My name is Michael O'Connell, and today I'm posting some more audio from the Society for News Design's recent conference here in Washington, D.C. I'm posting a very engaging conversation between Ezra Klein and Yuri Victor of Vox.com. We've had a few Vox people on the podcast before. Yuri was on talking about design of a new newsroom. We also had Melissa Bell and Matt Iglesias. Matt came on to talk about Vox's recent interview with President Barack Obama. Speaking of Obama, the opening clip is Klein talking about Obamacare, which is one of the subjects he considers himself an expert on. And it kind of is a good example of what Vox tries to do, which is to give context to stories, not just necessarily cover the breaking news or the latest controversy, but actually provide a depth of information about something that can be useful to readers. This is a really great conversation between two people who are working in a digital startup. I like having people from digital startups in. I've got some more audio coming from the same conference. I talked to a few other people who work at startups, and they can sort of provide that perspective of what it's like working in a digital-only newsroom and, how you have to sort of adjust your thinking and to take advantage of things like social media and breaking news. And in the case of Vox, how can you cover a story that a lot of people know about but may want to know more about or have more detail? With this podcast, I missed the first part of the presentation. I missed the introduction and I think the first question asked. But we begin with Ezra talking about Vox.com's first year online, what they've learned and where they hope to go.
In terms of where we are a year in, Vox is in its reach and its market share and all those kinds of things that we need to just keep growing. It's doing really well. We're roughly 20 million uniques a month. We have a staff of around 40. Some amazing people are joining this year. But we are still very, very young in terms of achieving that goal, in terms of becoming the kind of news resource that we think we can be for our readers. We're doing a big technological overhaul of the card stacks right now, a big editorial overhaul of the card stacks. I think in the coming months, they'll become a lot more useful even than they are today. But that's a slow process, figuring that out, learning how to do that, figuring out how to make sure it is there for the reader when they need it. That's the stuff that is the most exciting part of what we're doing, but it's also the one that doesn't come as quickly. So it's doing well, but we are very, very, very far from being a success.
Yeah, and I think we were just doing, we just did a poll on the Affordable Care Act, and we asked people the questions of, is this true? Is this false? And, people completely bombed it. They even, how long has this been going on? Like, years. And they still don't know anything about it. So, obviously, we're failing at getting this information to people somewhere. And I think, you kind of, felt, very nihilistic. Like, what are we fucking doing here? Like, we're all been trying to do this. Everybody here has worked on something for this, and it's, not made a difference. There's, it hasn't changed. What do you think is going wrong?
So I think that I am very, very, very nihilistic, I want to note, just as a starting point. But I'm not as worried by polls like that as some people are. So what you're going to find if you poll people on the Affordable Care Act, I'm told that yesterday somebody came up here and said, "Can anybody here actually explain Obamacare?" And it kills me that I wasn't here. I've been waiting. That's like my bat signal. I've been waiting for that to happen my entire life. Doctors will tell the story of the time they were in the grocery store and somebody collapsed. Being in a room where just somebody shouts out, "Can anybody explain Obamacare?" It's the one thing where I could be a hero. We talk a lot about left-right polarization in the media. We talk a lot about the idea that people are cocooning in different kinds of information sources. And it's a very, very important thing. It's a very damaging thing. And we can chat more about that later. There's another kind of polarization we don't talk about, which is interest, non-interest. But it's a very fundamental polarization. The difference between people who want to learn a lot about the news, want to learn a lot about Obamacare, and people who don't is profound. And something that I think we have trouble with in the media is realizing it's okay. It's okay for people to not want to know everything about Obamacare. American politics is not set up to require every citizen to spend their entire life reading the Affordable Care Act. We've built a representative democracy. We have very sophisticated mechanisms for sorting information, for giving people cues. What we need to be doing in the media is making sure, one, that all of the people who want to be informed can be informed, and two, that being informed is not just straightforward and easy, but actually appealing and fun. And I think we often get much too concerned about the idea that some people just don't want to be reading political news. That's okay. I don't want to be reading all kinds of things in the world. I really don't want to watch baseball games, like, at all. Like, and that's just got to be all right with the world. And I really feel the same way a lot of times about politics. I think that sometimes we can get a little high and mighty about the degree to which every citizen needs to be reading our stories for them to be a good citizen. But what we need to be working on and what we need to be very, very clear about is that a lot of the times people come to us and they can't find the answers they're seeking. A lot of the times people are looking for information and we aren't there to provide it to them. We ceded, as an industry, an enormous amount of ground to Wikipedia in a decision we never even talked about. That's not true in other industries. If you get a rash, and I'm sure some of you right now have a rash, but if you get a rash, there is a Wikipedia page on rashes, but you don't go and visit it. You go to WebMD, you go to Mayo Clinic, you go to Cleveland Clinic. In the health space, it is just not the case that Wikipedia is the leading provider of all information, all contextual information about the universe. But in our space, we've let them be that way. And this is, for me, a big part of what led to founding Vox. I covered Obamacare very, very aggressively for 5 years. My colleague, Sarah Cliff, who's just the best healthcare reporter in the known universe, covered it with an incredible level of dedication since before it was ever called Obamacare. And yet, every day we would get onto our site, onto back then Wonk Blog, and we would answer the question, what happened in Obamacare today? And then we would look at our email, and that was not the question our readers were asking us. They were asking, how do the exchanges work? How does the individual mandate work? These questions that we had answered for them before, but that we weren't somehow able to connect them with that day. And so that's where I think polls like that unnerve me. It doesn't unnerve me that there are a lot of people who don't care that much about learning about Obamacare. It unnerves me that there are a lot of people who do care, but on the very fundamental things are misinformed. And the reason I think they are misinformed is we don't cover those things. We don't talk all that much about the basic parts of the bill. We talk about the controversial parts of the bill, the parts that the people are fighting over, the parts that are changing. But almost by definition, those parts are often less important. They're less central. They're less settled. The stuff that is just fundamental to how the thing works, because it doesn't change day to day, we don't really have good ways to cover. And we don't really have good ways to give people the information we've already built on that. And so they go, even if you are a dedicated news consumer reading about Obamacare, you just could be that person and just never see the information needed to answer those poll questions correctly. Meanwhile, you would know everything about what idiotic thing some politician said today about it that wasn't true. And that's a deep imbalance. That's a failure on our part.
Well, how do you think that we change that then?
Vox. You know, but it's kind of a joke, but what we are trying to do is to change that, right? So the idea is that the new information is not the most important information. That I remember there's a line an editor once said to me, which is the first three letters of news are new, right? N-E-W. And I remember thinking, and he was saying that, it's like, that's awesome, right? You've got to be focused on what just happened. And I remember thinking that's the problem. That we were on a technology for a very, very long time where we had to somehow limit how much we were going to tell people every day. We couldn't give them the phone book every day. And so we limited it to what was new. And we made it their responsibility to know all the things that were not new. We made it their responsibility to come in every day with all that background knowledge. And a lot of what is new is not what is most important. And I think being able to come up with ways, both on the product and design side, but also in terms of our editorial thinking, in terms of our editorial processes, in terms of what we ask of our writers, making it easier for them, more straightforward and more natural, to come and say, today I'm going to write about something I think is important that isn't new at all. I think that's a real challenge. It's one of the things that we struggle with a lot at Vox, right? Even there, where it's a big part of our culture that what is new is not what is most important. What is new is by far the easiest way to structure your day. You come in, you have to write something. You have this whole universe of things to write about. How do you narrow it down? And what's going on today, what all your colleagues are writing about, what's already blasting through Twitter, there's so much pressure to go in that direction. It is such the easiest path to take that even when we don't mean to do it, we do it. So trying to think about different ways to change that incentive structure, to get people thinking about parts of these bills and parts of these stories that there isn't pressure to write about that day, but that the readership needs to know about anyway. I think it's really hard, but I think if we succeed or fail, it'll be resting. It'll turn like on that question.
There's a human aspect to that, that it's really, really hard to do that, right? Like, there's, you know, being able to keep something updated, to have it live on, to be able to answer that questions, and to have that like proximity where you're so close to this issue because you've been now covering this card stack for a year. Like, how do you step back? How do you like? I mean, because you had there is a very human thing, and it takes a lot of time.
Are you all tweeting this? Because if so, this. Twitter is such a fucking goddamn disaster for journalism. I love Twitter. I love reading it. I love everything about it. But like, and if you use it well, it is such a powerful tool. But what journalists do on Twitter is they follow other journalists and they talk to other journalists and they just speed up the tendency to write for each other. And it is so dangerous. If you are like following experts and normal people like outside of your world on Twitter, it's such a great place to find new ideas. It is such a powerful tool for listening. But what I see happening on it so often is we've taken the editorial meeting that already had this problem of us writing for each other in our industry, and we've made it constant. We've made it 100% of our time. We've given it a push notification. And it's so bad because it really makes us write the same thing, right? It really speeds up the kind of feedback we get from our peers. And for a journalist, right, the power of getting feedback from your peers is really something. It's really significant. It's really direct. In a way that everything else we do, traffic, we don't have a good measure for informing our readers. We don't have a direct measure of people came to us with confusion and left with understanding. There isn't a way to get the reward off of that as quickly as there should, as we wish there was. But there is this way now to get this instant feedback from your friends that you broke the story, that you pushed it forward, that you were on the cutting edge, and you said something they'd never heard. And your friends in journalism, they are so different from your readers. They are so fundamentally different from who you're meant to be writing for. They know so much more. This is one way I think we're getting worse, not better. This is a way in which, for all the analytics we have, for all that we know about our readership, I think that we really need to be conscious of how much pressure there is to write for each other. And that's a totally rational thing to do. I want to be super clear, right? If you are writing for other journalists on Twitter and you're a journalist, that's a really good way to get a job, right? You're impressing editors, you're impressing, you know, people who can recommend you to editors. It is not an irrational, dumb thing. It is not valueless. But I think we always have to be really cognizant that the knowledge level of our audience is different. You know, when we started, and one of the things we struggled with a lot is, well, particularly when we're doing card stacks, what is the first question? If you want to do a card stack on marijuana legalization, Do you want to start with one, what is marijuana? On the one hand, people who feel very knowledgeable, who it's important to their self-conception to be knowing, they bristle at that. Even if, honestly, they don't know that much about marijuana, right? It's a Schedule II drug. It's actually rated the same in drug scheduling as heroin. There are all kinds of really interesting things there. But people, they feel insulted. Meanwhile, a lot of, like, folks who are coming to an issue new, they don't know that much about the very fundamental question. When we started, there was, I forget who it was now, but it was some, like, snarky New York publication. It was like, Vox, the new publication for explaining things to your dad. And I remember thinking about that for a while and thinking, they think that's like an insult, like a devastating like line that we would want dads to know about things. Because like dads are supposed to exist in some state of like ignorance because they have kids and don't have... And I just, it was really telling to me, like, it's very hard in journalism right now to not always have the attitude of being a knowing journalist in this competition to write the smartest thing that the other journalists have read. And I don't know, this is one of the things that, like, when I feel like being pessimistic about journalism, I become the most pessimistic about. Because if it becomes uncool, if there becomes social sanction for journalists to write the things that the readers who don't know anything about the topic need to read the most, then we're failing in some very profound way.
But and so you're talking a little bit about social. How do you feel about that way about all social? Is it just Twitter? Like, do you feel that all social is, like, the way that we're using social is changing how we tell stories too?
Yeah, I am a huge fan of what just social media in general, because it has the exact flip side of this too embedded in it. It allows us to be in this constant communication with our readers that we just weren't in ever before. We have this capacity to see in a way we didn't know what stories matter to them. And I think that's really powerful information. So I'll give like a direct example. Something that has happened in the transition to social has been that stories about people's gender, race, and sexual identities have become much more common. And there is a certain amount of friction and confusion and agita in the industry about this, right? Why are people writing all these stories about, you know, what some people call political correctness? And what I think has happened to some degree is we entered into a feedback loop we didn't have before. One reason these stories get so much attention is that they do so well on social. But the reason they do so well on social is these stories are really important to people. They're really fundamentally important to people. And when we had newsrooms where we wrote for an audience we already had, because there's no way for an individual story really to go viral, to get shared beyond your audience, when the newsrooms were run by, you know, white men, when you just had less information and less diversity, you didn't know that. You maybe should have, but you didn't. And so the ability to know what resonates with the audience is so important. And it can help you so much in correcting your own biases if you're watching for it, right? And again, but this requires a very conscious effort to be using this not as, one, just a broadcast mechanism, but two, not just as your own social network. You need to be finding a way to listen beyond your social network. You need to be finding a way to use it to get the kind of feedback you're not going to get, which is feedback from people who aren't in your newsroom, who aren't in your industry. And that is where I think like the problem on social for journalists comes in. It's very easy on Twitter to follow all your friends, to follow all your competitors. It's very easy on Facebook to do the same. And so it can have the tendency to make you narrower. But if you're really conscious of that, and if you really try to use it to go the other way, it can expose you to kinds of feedback that you really had no ability to see before. And it can really help us in journalism recognize what's important. One of the things that I think is a significant part of all this is knowing that, like, or is being open to the idea that the beats we have considered important up until now are not, that was not handed down from Mount Sinai on stone tablets. What we consider beats, what we consider hard news, what we consider worthy of coverage, there are all kinds of cultural and technological and business reasons that newsrooms evolve that way. And being willing to see maybe that there are things that we've been systematically undercovering as an industry because we were serving a particular kind of audience, because we didn't have very good information about what our readers cared most about, that can be really, I think, transformative. And I think it has been. I think in ways that are both very visible and not very visible at all, I think it really has been. I think that we do a better job covering stories of importance to our audience. And I think that, but I do think that at the same time, it's really hard to use social that way day in and day out, to really use it to be listening for that. So you're not just seeing things go viral, but you're also hearing where are the points of confusion, where are the points of pain, where are the points of friction in society. I think we're really at the beginning as an industry of learning how to use this as a strong reporting tool, not just a broadcasting tool.
Yeah. Well, it's not just social as a feedback loop. We have so much more information than we've ever had before with analytics and like all this data coming in, but we're also still missing like a ton of stuff. Like we were talking about, if somebody wants to come to our site and they want to find an explainer and we don't have that explainer on our site, we have no idea that we didn't serve that reader, but we failed them. And so like there's so much that is missing with analytics, right? What do you think is working out there?
I think analytics are tough. We try to be really data-driven at Vox. We really do. Kyle Keller, who is our analytics editor, is just fantastic at this stuff. And we can learn so much. And then sometimes we absolutely cannot know the things that are most important. And the hard thing in analytics is knowing when to stop, when to realize that the analytics are not telling you anything more than they really are. So anybody who is Chartbeat, which I assume is most organizations in here, knows that little part in the corner, the sort of bottom right, where it shows you how far down the screen people are scrolling. And that is like the blue box of death. That is like the blue box of, sorry, you did not do as good a job on this as you thought you did. And that's a very helpful blue box. I will say, it gets a little hard. The world of Instapaper and Pocket and things, people come to longer stories, and a number of people will just immediately pocket them. So now it looks like the bounce rate on the story was crazy, and the story, nobody scrolled down, but it just meant they were going to read it later. So you got to be careful, too, with where that data is failing you. But the thing that worries me the most about the analytics we have is we can tell that people read something or came to it. We can't tell if they understood it. And by the same token, too, you can have a huge analytics win with a story that is incredibly trolly and offensive. Like at the end of the month when you check your comm score, a story that everyone on the internet read because it was extremely racist makes your comm score numbers look excellent. And that's an extreme example, obviously, but we do need to be careful with that work. We need to be data-informed, but being data-informed means being informed about the data, too. And I think there's a lot of smart thinking about the limitations of it now. Jonah Peretti from BuzzFeed has this good line that there's no God metric, but I also think that it is very hard, even knowing that there are limitations in the data, not to organize yourself around what you can measure, right? It is very hard, even knowing everything that we know about where the data can't take us, not to nevertheless be targeting the data, because at least then you can get feedback. Qualitative metrics are much tougher to organize a newsroom around. They're much tougher to enforce. They're much tougher to give people a feeling of a feedback loop on. And yet, they're often much more important, particularly for your editorial mission.
And I think you're kind of hitting on the idea of clickbait, right? Like these articles that you come into and you read, and they do well on social maybe because the headline, but then they don't necessarily serve the reader.
Yeah, so clickbait is, I think, a very complex term right now in journalism. It can mean a lot of things. Typically, an article I didn't like, but also an article that didn't deliver. My definition of clickbait, and Matt Iglesias wrote a good piece about clickbait for us, but my definition of clickbait is not that the article headline had a curiosity gap in it, right? There's a certain thing about clickbaity headlines. And I want to be clear on this. I would really like my headlines to make you read our articles. Bait is a not bad metaphor for what we are trying to do with headlines. If they do not make you want to click, the headline has failed. So I think that there's a sort of weird... The clickbait term is weird to me, but... What I do think is really important, what I do think is really hard, is when you click in and the article doesn't deliver on the headline. That, to me, is the problem with clickbait on the internet right now. And that, to me, is part of the short-sightedness that can be pushed by these kinds of metrics, right? You're trying to target... I want to talk about this from inside the box perspective. We have a headlining process where we come up with about 10 headlines for every post we put up. And those headlines are voted on by a jury of your peers. And one of the problems with having your headlines voted on a jury of your peers who maybe didn't read the initial article very closely is they have a tendency, it's kind of like the Coke-Pepsi challenge, right? Where like people go for the sweetest thing over and over and over again, but then in aggregate they actually don't want the sweet thing all the time. And so one of the things that we have to be very careful with is that, you know, we try to have this process so we're very intentional about our headlines, and so you're getting feedback on your headlines. But there can be sort of like quiet, natural incentives in that process to push the headline beyond where the article can support it. And then if you're doing an A-B test, you know, you're looking for that conversion rate, and you see it being higher in a headline that maybe is, again, like a little bit more aggressive. And that will look like a win that day. That article will do better than the median article. And maybe it won't even cause any problems, right? Maybe it'll just underdeliver a little bit. Readers will leave not having had a great experience, but not a terrible experience. They're not going to go be angry at you over it. And so that day, it looked like that writer had a good day. It looked like your site had a good day. But you do that over and over and over and over again, and you destroy your brand. Over time, readers learn that your stories aren't really very good. And so that's a place where you have to be really careful. There's very little that's worse as a reader than to come into a story and feel a bit betrayed, to come into a story and realize it isn't what you had meant to come into. Like that isn't visible in the metrics, but it will be visible long-term in the success of your organization.
I think you're just kind of hitting on the having empathy for the person that's reading the article. That's something I think you touched on earlier of like the newest thing, the thing that everybody heard about was that gotcha moment where that politician made a mistake rather than the actually really important thing that they meant to say, which actually had a really big impact. And so it's like empathy for both your audience and maybe possibly even for the people that you cover.
Oh, God, yes. Empathy is such a... We have this internal... guide at Vox about what our tone is supposed to be, what we are supposed to sound like to our readers. And one of the points in that is remember that everyone you're writing about is a human being and everyone you're writing for is a human being. And when talking about the people we write about, we're often catching them on their worst day. And we're often catching them out of context. And we're often catching them at a moment when they just express themselves really poorly, which we all do. Which I'm sure I've done four times in this talk. And the incentives of the web are, and particularly of social media, are to maximize the outrage, are to pump everything up. And it's really bad. I in some ways I wish I had like a smarter point to make on this, and it's bad. But it is something that readers really respond, by the way, in my experience. The audience responds to nuance. They respond to trying to be very generous. They respond to trying to, like, take things, you know, at their best. But it's harder to do that. It takes longer. People don't always do it. And oftentimes you as a writer are angry. You as a writer are offended. You as a writer are pissed off. And like, you know, and everybody's doing it. Now there's social pressure to jump in on the thing. And reporting at its best is not just finding out facts and scoops, but finding out why other people are the hero of their own stories. It's finding out why people are doing the thing they're doing. In political journalism particularly, we often forget this. Cynicism is an incredibly overused explanation for why people do what they do. I've been reporting on politicians for, you know, a bit over a decade now, and I have very rarely met one who I truly thought was cynical. The human capacity to convince yourself of whatever you need to believe is so much more powerful than we give it credit for, and the natural tendency to not want to feel like you are saying things that aren't true, it's so much more powerful than we give it credit for, and yet we routinely describe politicians as cynical, calculated. At that moment, they're very sincere. One thing politics selects for is the ability to be sincere about one thing 1 second, and then sincere about the opposite thing in the next second. But nevertheless, the experience of sincerity is an important one. And I don't know, we really need to do a better job when these sort of 2-minute hates come about, taking a breath, and even if we do want to push against the thing that was done, finding out why it is that the person who did it thought they were the hero of that story. And that's something, by the way, where I think also this is a place where social media has been bad. Because on Twitter and on Facebook, people talk about Twitter, it's got the 140-character limit. But if you look at how we all use Facebook for the most part, how most particularly news brands use Facebook, the actual amount of text that goes into a Facebook post is very limited. Right? You have a sentence or 2 sentences in the blurb, then you have the headline and the promo deck or whatever you want to call it. And so when you do that, there's actually not much information in the units that are spreading around the internet most aggressively. There might be a lot more information in the story, but the part people are hearing, even if the story is nuanced, is very unnuanced. And it just makes them, it makes them feel okay hating that person. And this, I think, is bad. I just really think that we need to rediscover sometimes a little bit more empathy than we have.
And how do we start to, I mean, because that's, you know, I mean, that's cultural, but that's organizational. Like, how do we start to do that in newsrooms? Like, I think that's a really tough change, because I think that's for, it's been like this for a long time, for as long as I've been in this business.
Well, it's on all of us, right? It's on editors. It's on editors like me to not go and praise somebody for jumping on the outrage train and getting 100,000 views when what we did was we jumped on the outrage train and just added outrage. We didn't help. We didn't explain. We didn't have people leave, like, really feeling the issue's complexity. It's on writers. This should just be a value. It's a value in journalism. You don't get things wrong. Even, listen, if we could just get things wrong all the time, this would be much easier. Like, wrong stories are super interesting. But it's a value, you know, I mean, we as a as an industry, sometimes we forget how powerful our norms really are. In a lot of newsrooms, you call 3 people before you ever put a story up, right? That's a hard thing to do. It slows you down. It stops you. We need to develop these things as values, even when they make our work harder, even when they make it, even when they're going to reduce our total traffic for that day or that month. Sometimes we can pretend in journalism, particularly in web journalism, because it is so competitive and it's so new, and it can have this feeling of us all being buffeted by forces beyond our control. We can sometimes take this stance like we're helpless. Like we are helpless against the incentives of the industry. Like we're helpless against what people want on social media. Like we're helpless against the need to be incredibly fast. And we're not. These things are choices. Every one of them is a choice. And oftentimes you can succeed more by taking harder roads, but they are harder. But we've got to make these choices. And we can't pretend. Something I've always really disliked in journalism is the distance between writers and headlines. Headlines will go out and the headline will be really too far or something, then the writer can say, oh, that was a copy desk. The part of the story everybody saw, I had nothing to do with that. We need to take responsibility for what we're doing sometimes in ways that we don't.
Not, and not just headlines. It's all the entire process. It's the photograph that gets chosen. It's the you know, a lot of that sometimes gets put into different buckets. It's somebody else's job, right? And it's not my job. And so, like, how do you start to build newsrooms that collaborate like that and they are working together?
You don't separate people. I mean, where do you sit, right?
I sit in front of you.
You sit in front of me. And Melissa sits on my left and Matt sits on my right. And, you know, people talk a lot about collaboration as if it is something that is about process. And to some degree it is, right? There's a lot of collaboration that needs to be built into process. But a lot of it needs to be built into the social fabric of the newsroom, right? A lot of it needs to be built into people being friends and getting drinks. Alicia Ramos, who's a developer at Vox, had this great piece for Nieman Lab, I think it was, about how the critical thing in building a culture where editorial and product and design and all of it really work together is for people to genuinely be best friends, is for people to genuinely just like each other and have constant organic interaction. And I think that's a lot of it. I think a lot of it is having people with different skills and different equities and different values and different backgrounds in the conversations naturally. A lot of organizations have a real support desk model. And the support desk model, I think, will tend to fail you on a couple of different dimensions. And here I mean the model where the way things get built, the way things get designed, the way a visual gets made is kind of the editor or the writer like walks across the room and like sacrifices an ox and like hopes that they can get it onto the priority list. And to some degree, there's always going to be a dimension of that that's true, right? Like everybody's got, like every writer, we can't do everything. But it's important, I think, that people are not just working together day to day so that the ideas are being generated not just by writers, but by people with other kinds of expertise, but also real knowledge of the subject. So as we're building our graphics team this year, Javier Zaracena from the LA Times is coming to be our graphics editor. You know, we're going to be building that team just as we have with our video team, where individual designers, they're really attached to reporting groups. Like, they're looked at as reporters. They're not looked at as people who kind of just do something on the back end. Like, they're expected to be coming up with the stories. But in addition to that, it's just really important. One thing this support desk approach tends to encourage is a lot of spatial separation. If the graphics department is over here and the politics writers are over here, their ability to become friends is just naturally going to be reduced. And then that's going to hurt you in ways that you never see. You can see when a process doesn't have all the key people in it, but it's very hard to see something that would have been thought up and would have been great, but never happened because the two people didn't know each other.
How do you think we're doing with this? It's been, you know, a year.
This part I think we're doing really well with. I mean, you would in some ways probably know better than me.
I give it a thumbs up.
But and the way I judge it really is that social one. I see who the reporters hang out with. I see who they talk with in Slack. I see what our Slack rooms look like and how many developers and designers and, you know, folks from all corners of the organization, folks who were not working on Vox.com at all, are in the culture Slack room or the politics Slack room. How many people from the, how many writers are in the Viz Slack room or the video Slack room. That stuff is really important. Like, that is, I don't just measure the success on this based on, like, what are the editorial apps we build. Like, I feel like you see it or you don't see it in who comes to drinks. And, like, I've been really encouraging on that.
I want to start talking about next year. We're coming into year two. What do you want to see from this? What do you want to see us do?
A better job.
Yeah.
look, we need to get we're so young. Like, we are trying to figure things out fast, and year one was successful. Like, our traffic is great. Like, the huge danger is that we now flatline, that we come in every day and we manage the site to be successful at what it is doing that day. That we sort of assume that we've built it, that this is what we are, and what we need to do that day is come in and write a bunch of articles and produce videos and create graphics that people are going to enjoy on the internet that day. This is one way in which the growth we've had is actually a little dangerous, because it puts a lot more pressure to make the site, like keep the site's traffic up and so forth, like each day, right? We've matured really quickly, but long before, in my view, we figured out some of our harder problems, like in terms of how to attach the contextual information to the new information. And so in year two, like, we really need to keep a hard emphasis on building the thing we ultimately intend to be, as opposed to running the thing that we are now. And it's the thing that scares me most, because this is like, if there's going to be this failure, if we do fail at it, will be more mine than anybody's, right? Like, it's so easy to come in and, you know, it's like Hillary Clinton is announcing for president this weekend. I spent a lot of my week thinking about how to cover the Hillary Clinton announcement. But the Hillary Clinton announcement is going to go away at some point. And like this whole year, there are going to be things like Marco Rubio is announcing on Monday. There's going to be primaries. There will be debates. There will be so many events that we need to cover, and so many day-to-day opportunities and problems and hiring processes and all of it. Running the site is a hard job, like, I think. even before you talk about trying to run next year's site, right? Or the site we're going to have 3 years from now. And so I really, if 1 year from today, we are not substantially different than we are today, if 1 year from today you guys go to Vox and we seem really a lot like we are right now, then we will have failed. Not because Vox isn't good right now or people don't enjoy it or we don't produce things of value, because we do, but because we will have stopped. We are a very different thing today than we were when we launched a year ago. And we need to be significantly different a year from now than the thing we launched today. And not different for different sake. Different because we are traveling further and faster along the path we've set out for ourselves. Different because we're achieving our mission, and because, you know, something we're going to roll out soon with Cardstacks, I think, will be a very big part of that. But we need to be, in very tangible ways, accomplishing the Explain the News mission and the sort of distribution of that stuff better than we are today.
Well, you know, we've done some, like, a bunch of different experimentations. Some of them have failed. Like, you know, we tried the tabs. We've tried strange things, like we have Vox sentences now, where it's, you know, story and sentences. We've doing bullet points and other, like, different stylized things. And like, one of the crazy ones was the we had this, like, really long explainer on the Affordable Care Act case versus the three sentences, yeah. And they both did really well.
Yeah,
and it's like the article format is, like, kind of weird and broken. And, like, what would you change?
Everything. I think that if you run a digital operation, a digital news site, and if at the end of each day you could print everything you did out and staple it together, and it would really make a lot of sense.
Like a newspaper?
A newspaper, a magazine. You have to assume you're not really taking advantage of the possibilities of the internet, right? If what you've created is something that can transport back to the previous technology so easily, then you have to assume you're not living up to the current one all that well. So you talk about the Obamacare explainer, here we're talking about the explainer for the Supreme Court case King v. Burwell. What is notable to me about that explainer is how many times it's been updated, how many times we've used it. 10? 8? Like, substantial updates as new things happen to that. That, to me, is somewhere where we're using our sort of core ideas about persistence, and we're using the capacities of the internet to create something different, to make it so that we don't need to redo so much of our work, to make it so that we can approach these things more quickly, to make it so that readers get a more satisfying experience. That I'm really, really proud of. And I think, as you say, like, I do think we're creative about story format. I think we do try to put things in a lot of different ways for a lot of different kinds of readers and learners and so forth. But I do think that, again, it is, the article is great. The article is a very powerful format. But I am pretty convinced that a much smaller proportion of our hashtag content should not be in article formats than it is. I think so many things are articles because we are so used to writing articles, and it is very hard to think about non-articles. Blowing up the article page, this tends to be a topic at design conferences. It tends to be a topic at Future the Media conferences. It's not as much a topic at sort of conferences about how to cover things. When you get writers in the room, they don't worry about the article page as much. And a big part of the problem is there. I don't think I've ever been to a Future of the News conference where all the designers in the room weren't ready to blow up the article page entirely. I think that argument has been won in this room. But getting writers, and I mean in some ways there's even an issue there, right? Calling them writers, right? But getting the people producing the information to not want to put it in article format, to think as naturally about putting it in other ways as about putting it in a sort of traditional article, that's a huge piece of that puzzle. And I think we're actually a lot further from success there than we are on the technological and UX side of it.
Well, I want to give people time for questions. So do you have any final thoughts? Anything you want to say?
Vox, explain the news.
Yeah, and, so we'll open it up for questions. And Matt's jumping around with the mic, so just if you want to raise your... We got a couple people... Anybody? No questions? That's it? All right, I'm going home.
I'll start out if nobody else has one. You mentioned readers not getting to a story and being disappointed, let down, confused, thrown off. You guys do a lot of creative stuff for advertisers, right? A lot of content marketing, a lot of Vox creative. You guys do some amazing work. Do you worry about the impact that has on readers or confusing them at all?
No, because we shouldn't. I mean, if our work is confusing people, then yes, I worry about that a lot. But I think Vox Creative is pretty good about not making that confusing. So number one, ambiguity is the killer here. Ambiguity about who did an article and why, that is a killer. It's a thing I worry about in this stuff most. Then there's, I think, the second thing about, do people come in and feel disappointed by what they got? And I do take your point on that, right? You've clicked into a headline, and the headline, you thought that was going to be by a Vox writer, and it's by a brand working through Vox Creative. The important thing there, I really do believe, and this is why I think the move to creative is significant across the industry, is that one reason people are disappointed is that we've made ads suck for a very long time online. I am not disappointed when I open up my GQ and read the ads. I don't get pissed off that these pictures of handsome men in clothing are interspersed and distracting me from the other pages with the pictures of handsome men in clothing. Like, and when I was young, I grew up in Orange County, California, and I would go to the paper and I would open it to the calendar section and I would look in the back for the movie listings. And the movie listings were an advertisement. That was a native ad. A lot of this stuff we are not inventing for the first time. We are just refiguring it out online. But that was part of the value to me, right? Like, there was ads in there. I mean, and for my parents, you know, the coupons and so forth, they were part of the product. I wasn't disappointed by those ads. I was happy they were there. And we have a ways to go yet, but we do need to get there where people click in. And sure, maybe they wish there was no advertising in the world, right? Maybe they wish that, you know, that they never saw an ad. But if they do see an ad, that ad should be good. They should find value from that content. I think this is something BuzzFeed has done well. I think a lot of people have had the experience of seeing a piece of BuzzFeed content that is from a brand advertiser and enjoying the content. And maybe the fact that it is an advertiser like bums them out for a second, But then the content is good. And then, in theory, that makes them like the advertiser a bit better. And everybody's won. Everybody's interests are aligned. The New York Times did that great piece of creative around Orange is the New Black. And, you know, it took me a moment to get over the cognitive dissonance that this piece was actually from Netflix. But it was a really good piece of work. In some ways, I think that around creative, we need to be working harder to over-deliver than in anywhere else in the organization. Because, as you say, the bar to making people feel happy about that is higher. But we have to cross that bar. We are not going to survive as an industry if people hate our revenue driver. Right? Like, it's just not going to work in the long run. That's not value. If they are literally downloading software to protect them from the thing that funds the journalism they're reading. Like, that is a really bad model. So, as somebody like who like wants to have paid journalists making good salaries doing great work, like, I am like genuinely passionate about the idea that like we need to be coming up with ways to create advertising that people actually like. We haven't done that up till now, really, that well. I mean, there are isolated examples of it, and it's beginning to happen. I think we're a hell of a lot farther now than we were 4 years ago. But the sort of display advertising world that we're sort of beginning in some ways to come out of, the targeted advertising, the direct advertising, we really like made people mad at our advertising strategies for years. And it's going to take time, and it's going to take a lot of work and a lot of effort and a lot of creativity to change the anger they have about that. To make them feel sometimes that ads can be actually good the way they sometimes are on television, the way they often are in magazines. I mean, every year we all get around the television and watch ads that's occasionally interrupted by football. And we think that's great. And then we all content ourselves the next day and put up the 25 best Super Bowl ads. And then you'll have people go and complain about native advertising. And it's weird. There's a weird disconnect between how much we're willing to like ads in other formats and how much we often hate them in our own. And we need to solve that.
No, good point. I think Matt has a question over there.
Hey, guys. So my question is about sort of analytics and metrics. And I appreciate your discussion about how difficult it is to measure understanding, not just traffic. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit more about that, since it's so key to your editorial mission and sort of how, I guess, you measure success.
Yeah. So this is something that we have, thank God, some really, I think, creative people in the organization. Melissa's here today. She's been doing a lot of work on this with Kyle Keller, with our engagement editor, Allison Rocky, our managing editor, Lauren Williams. And we've been thinking about this a lot, this question of, like, how do you measure success? And I wish in some ways I had a, like, more innovative, cool answer, right? Like, we actually had come up with a metric. But what it is a pretty flexible set of both quantitative and qualitative goals that are broken down in very, very, very clear ways so that we actually, it's not stuff is good, but it is us trying to define, like, what are the contributors to success in that area. And so, you know, if our goal is about traffic, then, like, we also need to have, like, what are literally the things we're doing to achieve that. But if our goal is understanding, our goal is to be, you know, one of our goals right now is, like, you know, be worthy of the explainer brand, right? Really double down on that. Really make sure that, like, when people come, they're getting that. We've promised it to them. They need to be able to find it. But there's a lot of, like, achievables in there, right? The way to look at that at the, on the other side is not be like, well, I think we were. It is, you have to discipline yourself more. And even that's not perfect, right? You can get those contributors wrong. But at least it forces a kind of accountability on you. So I think it's, you know, I think it is really approaching it is trying to approach qualitative goals in more the way we've approached quantitative goals, as things that we can actually on some level see whether or not we've achieved. And just like quantitative goals, we can sometimes achieve all the parts of a qualitative goal and we haven't really achieved the goal. Much like we can get a ton of traffic and not achieve the goal of informing the audience, but it gets us closer. I don't want to exactly run down all of our long-term specific goals for the organization. But let me try to think of an example here. So, like, here's one. One of the things we've been trying to think through is how to make the experience of short-form content better on our site. How to make, not that it's been bad, just that it has not been really all that thoughtful, right? There's a lot more attention. There's a dedicated editor for features, but there's no dedicated editors in the room for short, quick content. But often that stuff will travel the furthest. So that needs to be a good experience for the reader. So one of our goals was to really improve the short form, you know, experience. And so, like, that had very distinct pieces to it, you know, some of which we've done, some of which we have. And it was like coming up with a strategy. It was hiring a dedicated short form editor. Margarita Noriega, who has been at Fusion, is joining Vox in May, I believe, early May, to be our short form editor. It's, you know, and then there's some other things there that we haven't done yet, but it is achievables. It's not make short form better. It's do all these things that we think on the other end are going to be the ingredients of a better short form experience.
Got one over here.
Yeah, you talked about the blue box of death on Chartbeat, and I'm just curious, how do you think about the people that do get to the bottom of that blue box of death, the people that are the most engaged with your site, and versus, you know, somebody who's kind of a drive-by? I mean, do you see more value in the people that are highly engaged versus, you know, the sort of mass in terms of how you build your site, or do you think that there's, I mean, obviously you think there's value in the shorter attention span users also?
Yeah, I don't want to use the word value exactly. I mean, look, like, my dream is that everyone in the world is an extremely loyal reader of Vox.com who checks the homepage every day. I think that would be great. But I want to be careful here because I think that, yes, in some ways, the readers who are of the most value to us, they come the most, they're the most engaged with our content, they're the ones who give us ideas, are the ones who come a lot. But oftentimes, readers who need what we're doing the most are the ones who've never heard of Vox at all. And I think some of the things we're going to be doing over the next couple of months are really quite aimed at those readers. They're aimed at people maybe who've never heard of Vox and maybe never want to know about Vox, maybe never want to ever come back to Vox, but that in a certain context, we can really help them out. We can provide a service for them that they need. So I just think of them as different. But our mission to explain the news requires reaching people who are not obsessive news junkies, people who have the interest, but maybe not the constant time, desire, knowledge base. Maybe they've been turned off before because they were confused. So we really do need to reach those people, or we're, you know, on some fundamental level failing. In some ways, for at least the core explainer mission, which is, we do a lot of things that are not explainers, features and all kinds of other things, but some of our most committed readers need that stuff the least, right? Like, they're the people who have already read the Obamacare explainer. They read it on day one. Like, now they're actually really interested in how the thing is developing day to day. It's the people who never come, who maybe they just ran into Obamacare. They're doing their taxes or seeing the individual mandate. Now they're trying to figure out the individual mandate, and they need to come and get the answer to this question. And we want to give it to them. And if they never come back, but they had a good experience, that's okay. Like, we got them to understanding, and, like, you know, we hope they'll come back, or we hope that in the future, like, when this happens again, they'll come back. But, like, you know, that's okay.
We want to give the other side of the room a chance to ask a question if there's one over there.
And what time do we have?
We have about 5 minutes left.
Okay.
Hi, my name is Eric.
Hello.
Hi. Many of you guys come from the Washington Post.
It looks like a podium from where I am.
I'm sort of ducking from you. Many of you guys come from the Washington Post, right? I come from a similar, slightly smaller paper in Sweden. Do you think it would be possible to do what you guys did within such an organization, or do you have to break up and start a new company?
I think there's an enormous amount of innovation and just incredible journalism. I was saying this to somebody the other day. I don't think the new media, old media distinction makes a lot of sense anymore. I think a lot of the most innovative things happening in media are happening in quote-unquote old media. And I think there are new media institutions that are extremely traditionalist in certain aspects of their operation. So I think the capacity to innovate and do great things is true now in all kinds of organizations. I don't know what your paper is like in Sweden. My knowledge of the Swedish media is not what it could be. So you would know better than I do, but I am very impressed by how much you can do in organizations. In terms of why we started Vox as its own thing, the idea was that we needed to build an organization from the ground up that was dedicated to trying to accomplish sort of a singular thing. And that required us to build the technology differently. It required us to have sort of a clarity of focus. It required us to do all the hiring with that in mind. And I mean, it's definitely something we talked with the Post about, but the Post has an incredible newsroom. It has one of the leading newsrooms on the planet. Not wanting to get a huge amount of like distraction and, you know, in this other thing that would have to be semi-separate was, I genuinely do believe, the right move for them. Now, your place might be different in terms of their approach, but you have to know what you want to be good at, right? That's why we did Vox the way we did Vox. And it is not a bad thing to let some of these things pass by, right? It is important to be the best at something. You're not going to be the best at everything. So it's important that the kind of innovation that's going to work in an individual newsroom is innovation oriented towards the things that newsroom is best at, and the things that newsroom really needs to do to succeed. So as I said, it's hard for me to say anything about papers I don't know, but I think there's a tremendous amount happening in a lot of, again, like these old media organizations that is incredibly, incredibly innovative and that is, you know, is certainly things that I envy in my, you know, barely a year old organization. So this idea that was, you know, maybe a little truer 5 years ago, but that there's this gigantic innovation gap, I think a lot of that is closed. I don't buy it anymore. When I look around at who I need to learn from, it's a mix of organizations that have been around for months, years, and decades.
I think we have one more question over here if you're up for answering one more.
I am up for answering it.
Okay, thanks, Ezra.
I'm ready.
So, kind of to follow on from that question, I'm one of the news apps devs at the Seattle Times. I work in a fairly large newsroom, right? I mean, it's not huge, but there's a lot of people there. When you talk about having everyone in the same room and having everyone be best friends, I'm not going to be best friends with everybody in my newsroom. And when we talk about having Slack channels, I have Metro editors who are fantastic, but they come to me and they want to know why my interactive doesn't work on their BlackBerry. Like, and not a new BlackBerry, like the one with the trackball. So in that kind of environment, am I going to be able to get this done, or am I going to have to leave the paper and start my own Vox? Like, what's my potential for getting people in the newsroom involved in what I do the way that you do?
So one thing I should say is it is not the case, and I don't mean to suggest that everybody in the organization will be best friends with everybody else. It's more that the way it can be set up spatially and in other ways means that people, in terms of the 10 or 15 folks that they routinely interact with, they'll be close with people from a variety of different skill sets and parts of the organization. There are people in my organization that honestly I just don't know that well at this point. It's a very disturbing thing. But the point is that they should be working with designers, even if not all of the designers, but they should have their folks. So I just want to be clear that the point isn't that you need to be an organization of 20 people to do this. It's that what you shouldn't be is, no matter how big or small you are, is balkanized. You can be you can have people sitting somewhat randomly as large an organization as you want to be. In terms of the extremely specific question about how your particular life is going to go in the next couple of months, you know, it's been my experience that that newsrooms have connectors in them. This is something Melissa is really incredible at, Melissa Bell, and was incredible at the Washington Post. The way we began working together is that I wanted, we were starting the site WonkBlog, and different design and product things needed to happen to make that happen. So, you know, I had gone to the product team, and like I'd gotten on the sort of schedule and so forth. And in every meeting that I had, there were all the people who would be building this new product, and then this woman, Melissa Bell, who just ran another blog. And I would go to these meetings, and we would wait until Melissa arrived, because she didn't always arrive right when the meeting started. And it was, for months, unclear to me what she did. Like, nobody would do anything if she wasn't there, but I just wasn't sure what it was that she did. And what she had done was she was the person connecting tons of people in the organization who could get things done. She was the person who knew how to make everyone work together and talk together. And ultimately, that position got formalized. She became director of platforms, and then what she was doing became a very formal part of the newsroom structure. But she started doing it before that. And I've seen a lot of people who do that. There are people who, you know, are just really good in a newsroom at connecting different kinds of players. And so if what you want to do is have these kinds of collaborations at the Seattle Times, I mean, I very much think they're possible. There are, in any newsroom, people who are amazing at getting things done, like amazing makers. And the problem is they don't know the people who they need to be making things with. And if you're able to identify those people, and if you're able, through sort of sheer force of personality and happy hours, to make them talk to each other and get them on the same page and get them collaborating, like, that can have a lot of the effect you're looking for. It can be a very, very powerful thing.
I think that's where we are. Thank you very much to Ezra Klein and Yuri Victor.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.